This is an RNZ podcast.
We often get emails from people asking just why is it that if a hurricane strikes in the US, it's more likely to be in the world news here than one in, say, Bangladesh, which probably won't be, even if it affects far more people. Likewise, a storm in Indiana might make the news here, but not one in India, even if it's much more destructive and deadly. Now, partly this is down to the assumption that something that happens in the States will be more interesting to people here, though the previous census recorded 7 times more people of Indian origin here than people from the US. But often, the easy answer is the availability of pictures. But when the strongest cyclone in more than a quarter of a century to hit India last weekend tore through one of the country's poorer coastal regions, there were plenty of pictures for the media to seize on. News Hub at 6 viewers, for example, saw some in a report from ITV News from the UK.
The screams of students as the windows are blown out by Cyclone Fani. These were life-threatening winds, but as the crane sways, it still brings gasps of horror as the massive structure crashes to the ground in this densely populated city.
But the truly remarkable thing about this was that the normally densely populated city wasn't at the time. Now, the media knew that Cyclone Fani would be huge, as CNN reported the day before it hit.
Everyone in this area is in grave danger to get out of the way. They need to get away from this water, away from this wind, and into some place that is very, very strong. This is now going to be a devastating wind maker and storm surge maker right along the coast here of the eastern shore of India. A lot of people on the way, 100 million people will see something from this storm.
And the next day, TVNZ's One News reported the results of Cyclone Fani like this.
Up to 12 people died after Cyclone Fani made landfall yesterday. The BBC's Rahul Tandon travelled to one of the worst-hit areas.
The region had indeed been badly hit, and the death toll since then has climbed to more than 35. But the real story this time was not how many people died, but how few, considering the state of Odisha has the same population as Spain, yet far fewer resources to deploy against extreme weather. But they managed to do it, as RNZ News reported last Tuesday night.
Panjak Anand from Oxfam says authorities learn lessons from past disasters.
I think it is because of the 20 years of accumulated experience of the government of Odisha after the super cyclone of 1999 that they have really understood what needs to be done in the case of a cyclone like this. So they have done a marvellous job.
Under the headline, "How do you save a million people from a cyclone? Ask a poor state in India," the New York Times reported that Indian authorities whisked more than a million people to safety, executing a meticulous evacuation plan they've been perfecting since a disastrous storm in 1999. To warn people of what was coming, they deployed everything they had, 2.6 million text messages, 43,000 volunteers and nearly 1,000 trained emergency workers. There were also TV commercials, coastal sirens, buses, police officers and public address systems blaring warnings in all local languages. Now, one of the first steps taken after that 1999 disaster was the construction of hundreds of cyclone shelters up and down the coast. And someone who saw all that firsthand is Bob McCarrow, formerly a disaster relief expert with the International Committee of the Red Cross for more than 30 years. He now lives in Christchurch, and he told me that our planners and our media should be much more interested in what happened in India last weekend.
Look, in the Bay of Bengal cyclone in 1970, somewhere just around a million people were killed. The Bangladesh Red Cross started a program called the Cyclone Preparedness Program, and right round the coastline of Bangladesh, they built cyclone shelters, and they got volunteers with loudhailers, and so they would disseminate cyclone warnings, and they'd go around and door knock on every house and make sure that people knew, and they'd be told where to evacuate. So the next cyclone, 50,000 were killed. That was 1980. 1985, 20,000. Today, virtually no one. The same in India. The Red Cross, with the support of various governments around the world, has spent so much money on community preparedness, and we're seeing the benefit of it. For example, you know, when the Asian tsunami started in Boxing Day 2000 and 2004, you remember the big Asian tsunami?
Mm-hmm.
It hit Thailand, and I remember thinking it's going to hit the coastline of India. And I worked for 3 years on that coastline, and we'd put cyclone shelters all up and down the coastline of Tamil Nadu and Andhra Pradesh. Very few lives were lost. People went into those cyclone shelters, and they were strong enough to withstand the force of the tsunami. So, yeah, we're not good at telling those stories. You take a poor farmer who's just got half an acre of land. Today, when he buys a bag of cement, there's a small tax on that to pay for an insurance policy. So if he buys five bags of fertilizer a year, he's actually insuring himself. It's compulsory. So when these people get hit by minor or major disasters, the fertilizer companies pay them an insurance premium. It's brilliant to see what's happening.
Do you ever see this stuff reported in our media? Because, you know, we've had to deal with a few disasters in recent sort of contemporary history, and actually knowing how other countries develop their resilience might actually be helpful rather than just hearing death tolls and a few pictures of devastation.
There are hundreds of stories out there, but the media don't seem to pick them up. You know, often it's much more spectacular when you see a tsunami smashing into a Japanese village than it is to read about poor farmers getting insurance when they buy a bag of fertilizer.
That was Bob Macero, a disaster relief expert with more than 30 years of experience working with the International Committee of the Red Cross.